Well, welcome again to Food Conversation Season 4. Before we begin, we acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral unceded and essentially stolen lands of the Shkrepnik people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility for us all. Now today we once again have guests who are dedicated to enhancing food sovereignty in the Shuswap, which is the theme of our program, Food Conversations, and are doing so out of conviction rather than because they grew up on a farm. And that seems to be a theme for almost all our guests on the show. Joining us today in the studio, which is a wonderful thing to have you in the studio, are Maylene Loveland and Robin Schall, husband and wife farmers who have for 3 years operated a small but mighty certified organic farm called Loveland Acres on leased land in the Salmon River Valley. Like most of the guests on our show, Maylene and Robin have pursued a circuitous route to a life of farming as they seek a sense of balance in their life, something that we all desire. So welcome, Robin and Maylene, to Food Conversations.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Glad just to be here. Delighted to have you here. Now, you've both come a long way in your lives to be operating an organic farm in the Shuswap. So let's start with something very basic and a bit lighthearted, and that is names. So, Maylene, your names. Maylene's a very lovely name. It's got a nice flow to it. It technically signifies that you were born in the month of May. But and one source actually said about Maylene that it conjures up images of a beautiful flowering season full of hope and new life. I wish I had a name like that. So did your parents pick your name for these reasons? And were you actually born in May?
So, no, I wasn't born in May. Unfortunately not. And my name is actually both of my grandmother's names cut in half and put together. So I have a grandmother named May May, and I have another grandmother named Pauline. And so that's how they got Maylene. Somewhat interesting is it used to be spelled M-A-Y-L-I-N-E, but then people were calling me Maylene.
that's what it was originally spelled with an I.
Yeah.
So you had to do a change. We'll talk about Loveland because that's like the perfect name for a farm, right? Did you arrange that? Did you arrange for your father to have the last name of Loveland?
No, I actually, growing up, I hated having that last name. We used to get prank calls from the phone book, like back when people had phone books, because our last name was Loveland.
Yeah.
And so I never... Oh,
my goodness. I don't even want to... We won't even describe the kind of prank calls you got, but we can use our imagination. Now, Schall, on the other hand, is based on a German word for noisy and loud. And yet, you're pretty calm and organized and sort of settled. But were you a noisy baby, Robin? Were you the exception in the rule in the family?
I don't think so. We're all pretty quiet in my family and settled and calm.
Well,
I don't actually know much about my last name and haven't.
It comes from a German word meaning loud and noisy. Who knew? Hey?
Yeah.
Who knew? But on the other hand, Robin means bright, shining, and famous. So let's hope that you're that is the name that that settles you, and you have Loveland and good Lord, we're on to names. Anyway, what's in a name anyway? Ultimately, it's the person who matters. Right. Now let's start with a little travel because there's a lot of travel in your lives. Robin, you were born in a small town just outside Düsseldorf, and you moved into Düsseldorf shortly. Your family moved into Düsseldorf. It's a big city. You didn't have a background in farming, but there was sort of an appreciation for food, like good food or something like that in your life?
Yeah, actually I was born in Düsseldorf.
Right, and, in the big hospital or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, my parents grew up just in a small town outside Düsseldorf, and they moved into town. Just when they were starting having kids, they moved into the big city.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, the appreciation for good food came later on in my life, probably in my mid-20s when I started getting interested in good food.
So you were virgin territory when it comes to farming and food and all the mechanics associated with that.
Right, yeah.
And so, in fact, after you had finished the German equivalent of high school, you went into the graphic design and printing business.
Yeah.
Was that just something to do, or was it? What was the connection you had with that?
It came out of kind of desperation at first. not really able to find a job after school. So a family friend of ours had a printing company that I was able to get a job at. And I started the German training program for graphic design and printing.
A fairly detailed kind of program.
Yeah, you work in a company and you go to school on a weekly basis. Mm. Yeah.
So it's, and at the end of it, what sort of things were you able to do and did you do in the sort of printing slash graphics business?
Right. I was working mostly on the computer, getting the printing data ready for the press. And we had a little bit to do with large format printing too that I did for the company and getting signs ready for customers. And I would work closely with customers on the layout of their books too. And
So were you the guy who made it happen? They had the idea and you put it into
reality.
Right,
and they would maybe work with graphic designers to get their things designed. And then.
And was this sitting all day in front of a computer, was this your choice for the rest of your life?
Probably, yeah. That made it happen.
But somewhere along the line, it didn't completely satisfy you.
That's correct, and I was looking for something new. And
so, Maylene, unbeknownst to you, Robin, Maylene was being born in Calgary, and your mom was Chinese and your father was English. Now, that's a very rich cultural mixture. What was that like for you growing up, having two very different but rich and established cultures side by side in your life?
I have to say that my childhood was very much like North American, I'll say. So my grandmother moved to Canada when she was three, and her parents died when she was really young, and she had five sisters. And so they were raised by the church community in the small town in Ontario, and so had a very Canadian upbringing. As someone who's sort of half Chinese and half English, you kind of feel like you never fit in, because you're not Chinese enough to be Chinese, but you look different.
You'll be pleased to know that David Suzuki said the exact same thing. He wasn't enough Japanese for his Japanese family, and he wasn't enough Caucasian for the larger settler community.
Correct.
It's a common thing, yeah.
Yeah.
But did you learn it? Was Chinese culture around you when you're growing up?
No, really, like not my. I guess my so my grandmother ended up. She married a Chinese man originally, and he's a very interesting person. But they got divorced, and then she married a British man. And so again, like not a whole lot of that culture is coming generationally forward. My grandmother's sisters all married Chinese men, and there's more culture on that side of the family than our weird insular Canadian piece.
Well, weird insular Canadian sounds like a lot of us when we start out, but then we branch out. And you did a BA in English language and literature, which is very fitting with being thoroughly sort of anglicized to a degree, with a minor in psychology. What was that about? I mean,
It actually used to be the opposite. So when I went into university, I was majoring in psychology and minoring in English. And then my dad passed away in the middle of my university degree. And
that must have been hard.
It was. And so then when I came back, I realized that the only type of psychology I liked was the business of manipulating people. Learning and behavior.
Don't listen to this, Robin. Don't listen.
And so I didn't really think that that was a career I wanted to take. So I just swapped the two so I could finish the degree. And then that started on a whole other snowball. So
you moved to the Lower Mainland. Now, you had a bursary. Was that what helped you make the move, or was it something you got after you had moved?
Like the
Simon and Schuster.
Right. Yeah. The bursary. Yeah. That definitely helped me move. So it was like a 4-month internship paid in Toronto. And we also had the opportunity to go to a sales conference in New York with the American office of Simon & Schuster. So I just gambled on it, packed everything into a moving truck, moved to Toronto on a 4-month internship and said, I'll make it work.
As listeners will hear as we go along, moving from one place to another is not unusual in either of your lives. Seems to be, this is the longest it seems you've lived in one place for a while. But your actual degree was from Simon Fraser.
So the book publishing degree was,
book publishing, okay. Yeah. Oh, because there were the two parts there, the book publishing degree and the bursary that got you to travel on for 4 months.
Yeah.
And then you worked in Toronto, mm-hmm. because there were some roots in Ontario. You worked in Toronto for 6 years, mm-hmm. as a publicist. Mm-hmm. What were you publicizing?
Books. Trade books. Yeah. So I worked for a couple of big book publishers. I worked a lot on cookbooks, and also really enjoyed working with first-time authors. I came from a small press in Edmonton. That's how I got started in publishing, and part of that is because of a poet named Fred Waugh. He's 1/4 Asian and writes a lot about that existence.
Did that kind of reconnect you back to the parts of your family background that you hadn't seen?
Yeah.
A lot?
Yeah, and I did, when I switched my degree, I ended up kind of focusing on East Asian and minority voices, and so read a lot of those books and really got deep into that. I think I even won a book prize for something I wrote about this 1/4 Asian writer from San Francisco. So really got deep into that. They all wanted me to do a master's, but I didn't think academia was going to work for me, so...
Interesting. Both of you were doing things, but especially Robin, it wasn't necessarily ultimately fulfilling. And I guess you were kind of also kind of moving around from place to place. And then one day you end up on the Marvelous Edibles Farm. Now, I had to look up Marvelous Edibles. That's a name you cannot just walk past and say nothing to. Marvelous Edible Farms. Since you did the internship there, why don't you tell us what it's all about?
Okay. So I actually met Jens and Aisha, the owners of the farm, at the farmers markets in Toronto, where I sold for another farmer. But they are former chef and baker who started a farm. And they sell at some of the busiest and best farmers markets in Toronto. And they're a huge inspiration to us, I think, just with their cooking and baking background. And
it's an organic farm as well.
That's right. Yep. Mm-hmm. And
lots of acreage, 50 acres.
Oh, just unbelievably beautiful. Like 100 acres.
100 acres, 50 yeah. in pasture. Yeah, yeah, I was reading it up.
And they're right on the Niagara Escarpment. So right on the hiking trails there, okay. on the Bruce Peninsula. It's a fairy tale land.
So lo and behold, one day, Robin comes wandering in from Germany to work as a woofer. Why don't you talk about the worldwide opportunities on organic farms, which, of course, everybody calls a program for woofers. How did that happen? How did you get involved with that?
Right. So it was just good way for me to travel without having to pay for hotels or hostels. So when I came to Canada, I spent some time in Nova Scotia and I flew into Halifax and I stayed on a couple of farms on Cape Breton Island. And then I moved on to Toronto and ended up, because I was looking for a place to stay in the winter, I ended up on Marvelous Edibles Farm.
When you got the woofer program, is basically you get paid as you travel. You know, you go to some place and you work there for a while. What made you think of agriculture as the way ahead for you? What was it that drew you to that?
I just somehow got interested in it, wanted to see how it's grown, how it's all working out. And
Did it help that the owners of the farm were a chef and a baker?
It probably helped because we learned a lot of amazing things from them in terms of like using the whole animal and making stock for yourself and baking and all sorts of things.
So you did a lot of eating as well, I get the feeling.
We did, yeah. We ate a lot of potatoes in the winter on Marvelous Edibles.
Root vegetables.
Actually, there's this one. So we were rendering some, it must have been duck fat. And so they had like ground the fat and then they were slowly rendering it. And then the cracklings are really quite nice. And so every time I'd been walking past them, I'd been nipping one off with a little bit of salt on top. And then one of the other guys who was woofing on the farm came over to me later that day and he said, Aileen, do you know who else is nipping the duck fat off the table? He's like, that guy over there, Robin.
What an introduction. I mean, it was love at first nip.
Or, that's right.
Or fat crackling. Good Lord. Don't worry, everybody who's ever told how they met on this show has had a very funny story to tell about it. You were there specifically with respect to the craft program in Ontario, which for listeners who don't know the craft program, which is probably most people, it's the Collaborative Regional Alliance for Farmer Training. Clever little acronym set up right there. What was that? How did you get involved with that?
So that's part of the reason why I chose to go to Marvelous Edibles. So I'd been telling some of my other vendor friends in Toronto that I was sort of burnt out and displeased with my corporate life. And one of them had said, well, why don't you go to Marvelous Edibles? Because they're part of this craft training. And part of that internship was that we would visit another organic farm once a month. And all of the farms that were involved in the program would come on that day. And we would do a work project together and then also tour this farm. So over the internship, I saw a new farm every month, which was really cool because you saw all sorts of different processes and different ways of doing things.
Yeah. Different, yeah. And you realize that there's lots of ways to solve one problem. You can do it in lots of different ways. Just remind listeners that I'm talking today with Robin Scheil and Maylene Loveland, who are the owner-operators of Loveland Organic Acres. Loveland Acres. Honestly, this name, every farm should have a name like that. Something that really just... And I bet you don't get any crank calls these days when it's Loveland Acres. It's like, well, no, we don't want to go outdoors and do stuff like that. Well, you kind of, when you were talking before, you said you fell in love with the lifestyle. What was it? I'll give you each a chance to answer that question. Robin, what was it about the world of farming that grabbed your attention?
Probably it comes... Not probably. It comes with lots of freedom compared to your normal everyday life in terms of structuring your day the way you want it, in terms of having the freedom to take time off, if a farmer can do it, just in the middle of the day to go for a swim in the lake maybe. And
the plants permit you.
Right. And then, yeah, the freedom that comes with it of providing for yourself and growing your own food and raising your own animals.
So while you were working on the Marvelous Edibles farm, you were also maybe thinking a little bit that one day you might do this?
Yeah, I think the thought, I started playing around with that thought on Marvelous Edibles, yeah.
Maylene, what were you, what was your mind doing as you worked among the pigs and the cows and the vegetables?
I think that one of the most freeing parts of working in agriculture is no one cares what you look like when you show up to work. So, I mean, as a book publicist for 6 years, you look a certain way and you are representing, you know, both a company and a person. And so that takes a lot of time in your day.
Getting spruced up.
Yeah, putting on, I used to say, like, your penguin suit, right? So... You know, that was really freeing. And I think for me, too, it just felt like the most active way to be doing something about the problems that I was seeing in the world. You know, to when you really boil it down to, like, what do we actually need to stay alive? Food is one of those things. And so it felt like tackling that was the best way to make a difference. And I do come from it from sort of a, you know, voluntary community food side of the piece, I guess we'll say.
So Robin, were you having thoughts like that, or was it just like, I want to be free?
No, I have similar thoughts, and providing for your community, and
I mean, these are essentially value-based plans. There's a sort of an element of why we do what we do embedded in what you've just been talking about. And I think I must say that is very much in common with what most people on the show, because it's focused on food sovereignty, of course, people think, why should there be food sovereignty? And one reason is that, as you say, Maylene, it's one of the essences of our life, of food, water, and air. Everything else is kind of optional. Air is really important. At any rate, you also fell in love kind of with each other. And in fact, you were married on August the 8th, 2016. And I'll tell listeners that when we were discussing the date, Robin remembered the date, and then Maylene remembered the date after that, which was interesting that a husband remembers the date of the marriage. It's usually the wife says, no, dear, it was on this day. And it was because your mom came over. And that was a sort of a very dicey thing to get there on time for the wedding bells.
Yeah. So in Germany, you have to go to the marriage office to have your union approved, I guess. And so my mom was already coming for vacation. And so we were looking at our plan, and we were going to Vienna together because my mom is a painter and she wanted to see Gustav Klimt's stuff.
Well, there you are.
And and so there was only one day that we could possibly get married while my mother was in the country. And so we requested that day with the marriage office, but we weren't going to hear back until like 2 weeks before my mom arrived, whether or not this was possible. So it was a surprise for everyone. And in the end, it was really a lovely affair.
Where did you get married? In a field? Do you get married in a large church or a cathedral?
Well, you actually have to get married in the marriage office in Germany. So we got married at the Standesamt. There we go. Yeah. And then after that, we just had a little party at a little restaurant in a city park.
Well, there you are. And you got inspired because after that, you really started to take traveling seriously. Back to Canada, across Canada by train. What, three times? Three times altogether?
I think, yeah, most of the way.
Yeah.
Three times, yeah.
So what were you doing zipping back and forth across the country on the train? I mean, I've done it myself. It's a lot of fun, actually.
Yeah.
The first two times was when I just came over for the first time and we were just traveling. So, and then we took the train again, right? But just to Edmonton. I think.
Yeah, when we moved back from Germany, I guess we had so much fun on the train the first two times that we thought we'd do it again. And so we flew into Toronto and then took the train to Edmonton, where I have some friends. And then from there we went down to Calgary. I don't know. It's fun. You like pack a little 6-day picnic and, sit through the bogs of Northern Ontario for like 48 hours.
And then the prairies for 2 days.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. But BC came on to your radar because, of course, that's where you ended up. How did back and forth across the country, what was the siren call of BC that drew you in?
While we were traveling here, we just started working on an apple orchard just for the apple picking season and
so
thinning.
This was your woofer heritage coming to surface?
Yeah, but this time I got paid for the work, not only got room and board.
What a terrible burden for you. Not.
Mm-hmm. And so, after the year that we lived in Germany, when we moved back to Canada and lived for Calgary while I was waiting for my work permit, we decided to go back to the orchard and the orchard is down in Lake Country. So
you worked in the orchard as well?
We both did, yeah. So
and you got paid?
Yes, got paid.
Just checking.
We worked there for 3 years, actually, on a big orchard, 45 acres of apples and 10 acres of wine grapes. And we worked there year round, which is a weird thing to do if you want to start a farm, because farm labor is very low-paying job. But it was something we really felt we wanted to do because you can't learn how to take care of plants or grow food really from a book. Every tree, I mean, when you prune 45 acres of apple trees, every tree is different. And so sure. That was important to us and I think really informed the way we run our business now too.
You'd both had you'd been doing the Woofing Robin and Maylene, you had done the craft program. So you'd both been immersed in the practicalities of farming. When you came back out here, obviously, oh, by the way, you went to Germany because you had to go to Germany because in order for you to get Robin to get a work permit, you had to reside in Germany for a while. That was something like that.
No, I just got a work and travel visa for Germany, okay. Basically so we could stay together because his visa had run out. And so I got the identical one for BC. For Germany.
And then when you came back, have you sort of become a what they call a landed immigrant or something of that sort? Or are you still sort of a fellow from Germany who's visiting Canada?
I am a permanent resident in Canada, so that's what they call it when you're married to a Canadian. So I could apply for citizenship now, yeah. But the rule is that I would have to give up my German one because Germany doesn't allow dual citizenship.
Some countries are persnickety that way. United yeah. States gets all excited about that too. And Canada, you can have Canada and yeah. other countries. We're nicer about that. I'm glad to hear that about our country. So you worked in this orchard, Dorenberg Orchards in Lake Country. Now, they're not organic, but I looked at their website. They got a lot of interesting apples. I didn't know that one of the apple strains that we use all the time, Ambrosia, is actually quite recent. Mm-hmm. It was like, and it was found in the Okanagan. For heaven's sakes, what's going on here? What was the orchard like? What did you pick up there that enabled you to start saying, okay, we can do this?
I think a lot of good business management practices came from Madeline and Raymond. So Raymond is the orchard manager and Madeline is the woman who owns the orchard. So we just having a daily log book, and I did a lot of the record keeping for them as well. Mm. And then just when you're growing something so intensively on such a large scale, you develop very efficient systems to run that farm. And so, for example, on our farm that we started, we standardized everything. So everything is 100 feet long, all of our rows, which means that every piece of row cover, every drip tape, any kind of thing that we use can be used on any row. So things like that definitely came from
you have learned orchards. From German efficiency.
That's right. Yeah, but for example, the farm that we met on, Marvelous Edibles, they were not as organized. So they had like 100-foot rows, 600-foot rows, 675-foot rows. So if you wanted to get some irrigation out there, you were just like scrambling, finding fitting pieces, and yeah, that
patchwork.
Takes a lot of time.
Patchwork. Well, Maylene, you may well have learned the efficiency of having all your rows the same length, but as I was sort of reviewing some of the stuff you told me, I realized that when it came to travel, there was no sense of efficiency. It seemed to fly out of somewhere in your heart or your mind, and away you went. So I just actually wrote down your travel destinations, and Robin started in Dusseldorf, then to Halifax, Truro, Owen Sound, Ontario, Vancouver, Lake Country, of course, back to Dusseldorf, Calgary, Lake Country again, Vernon, and now Salmon Arm. And then Maylene, you weren't much better. You started from Calgary, went to Edmonton, Toronto, Owen Sound, Vancouver, Lake Country, Alberta, back to Alberta for a while, Dusseldorf, Calgary, Lake Country. That, honestly, I think listeners would probably feel a little dizzy hearing all the places you traveled to. Has that had an impact on you, going to all these different places and different ways of doing it? Robin, tell us about that.
I think we learned a lot traveling and different parts of the country and different cultures. And yeah, you kind of open up your mind and horizon to, especially for me, spending most of my life all my life basically in Europe until I'm 28, and then coming over to Canada, and it's a culture shock at first a little bit.
What do you do, Canada, Germany, compare and contrast in 25 words or less? No pressure.
It's much, much bigger here, and so much space, and yeah, the nature is beautiful. But we do have beautiful nature in Germany too.
You do have lovely nature. Yeah. You got the Alps along the south edge there, doing a nice job. Maylene, what about you traveling? I mean, you came from urban centers, but now you're on a farm, so lots of things must have happened in your perceptions of things.
Yeah, I think, you know, seeing different cultures and being in different places makes you a more creative person. You know, you just the diversity of culture, language, ways of doing things that you see. I think I noticed that a lot in Germany, that we're very, independent in North America. And like there was one day where I was like waiting for the cross light to cross and there was no traffic. So I just decided to walk. And then the woman on the other side of the street, her jaw like dropped to the street, like that I would even dare cross the street on a red light. And
this is in Germany?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. In Canada, they'd say, oh. Meet you in the middle.
Well, in Canada, the cars stop for you.
Yeah, that's correct.
That's right. As opposed to running you over. Yes, indeed. Well, there is obviously freedom. And we're going to talk a little bit later about how a challenge has arisen for you with respect to your farm that shows that there can be limits on what appears to be an open-ended project from time to time. And that is the difficulty since the owner of the farm that you were leasing moved away from health reasons. But before we do that, let's talk about Loveland Acres. What is the daily routine on Loveland Acres and the kind of format? Now, it's low till, high density, high rotation farming. So who wants to, in a nutshell, tell us what that means?
we aim to disturb the soil as little as possible. We grow in standardized 100-foot beds, raised beds as well. There's a number of reasons for that. They warm up earlier in the fall. They dry out faster in the spring. And, you know, we've really seen the benefit of that over the 3 years that we've been farming here. The first year we farmed here was very, very wet in the spring. And we were able to grow at a time when other people couldn't even get into their fields because of the way we grow.
High rotation, mm-hmm. Seeing and matching a lot.
Yeah, so yeah. That basically means like lots of spreadsheets. so all winter we make a plan for what's going where, if it's the first planting, second planting, third time that bed has been used. But so we actually only actively farm a half acre off the 2 acres that we lease. But because we use each bed more than once in a year, we produce quite a bit off just that half acre. Mm-hmm. And so we are able to feed quite a few people.
Just to remind listeners that my guests today are Robin Scheil and Maylene Loveland, who are owners and operators at the present of Loveland Acres, an organic farm just up the Silver Creek Valley. The raised beds is one thing, and the way you're doing it. How many food products do you generate? You have a few little two-legged animals running around as well.
We do, yeah. We had some small flock of turkeys this year, and we have some laying hens. But the amount of different crops that we grow, I've never counted, but probably exceeds 20 at least.
Maybe even up to 50. I mean, we've really been using this opportunity in the land that we've been leasing to see what the market wants and what we like growing. There's a couple of things that we really enjoy growing, like head lettuce. You can just ask Robin. He's never harvested a head lettuce because I want to harvest them all.
So you kind of mix and match with what you're growing, depending on what's doing well, what people are buying, what you like to grow, that kind of stuff. Those are all these factors that bear in on it.
Yeah, so we do grow a lot of tomatoes. That's a kind of a passion project for us both. We save all sorts of wacky seeds and You name a color, we have a tomato for you. So.
And do you do your own seeds? Once you've got an established plant that you really like and it's going?
We save tomato and pepper seeds so far. We've tried to save lettuce seed, but the deer always come and eat the seed head. And because we lease, we haven't invested in fencing.
You said you feed a lot of people, but obviously you feed a little wildlife as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And high density, what's specific about that? Like the plants are grown close together, or you have rows that are close together? What's that all about?
We do have rows that are closer together, so our beds are 30-inch wide, and the pathways in between are just 18 inches. So that's one part of the high density, but we also plant closer together and more on a smaller space than a conventional farm would
and
do.
And that's in part perhaps the result of the fact that the acreage you have is fairly small. It's not like 20 acres or 50 acres. Or it's what, a total of about 1 acre that you're actually farming?
Actually farming vegetables is about a half acre, and then we use some of the pasture around it for the animals. Mm. But I guess the best way to explain our farm is that we're basically human powered. Yeah. So we don't have a tractor, like a traditional tractor. We have a walk behind tractor. So it's a BCS. Yes.
With a good old power takeoff.
Yeah. I think that's a really important conversation when you get into like organics, because one of the biggest difference between organic farming and non-organic farming is labor. And that's what's expensive, is labor. And most labor is not paid fairly. So
truly, truly so. That's a widespread perception around the world. And in fact, the food system that has been operative in the last 50 to 70 years has been one which traded on the fact that you can find places where people are paid even less than agricultural workers in this part of the world. And that means that the cost of growing the food is less. It also means that the workers are treated not very well. And when you do the work yourself, you realize how much is involved and how much skill there is involved in just things like processing lettuce. You know, it's not just a simple thing where you go whack, 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 and then put it in a box and send it to the market. You have to do it right. And if you do it right, you can also produce a lot of food off your land. You can really process it. I sense a sense of organization. You both did publish, you know, worked with preparing books and, you know, working in sectors where there's a lot of precise organization that has to be taken. And it seems like that's an element in your farm as well.
Yeah, we're both very detail-oriented and organized. And
that's why you like Mother Nature, because she just does what she wants to and tells you afterwards. Oh, dear. So here you are. You're on your farm. Everything's going fine. You've got your dream job. Did that dream sort of gestate? Did it form while you were working in the orchard? You know, you saw them, the large scale that they had to have, they had to organize. You were doing the books, Maylene. Did that kind of inspire you to say, okay, now we know how it works. We can maybe do something ourselves. Robin, what do you think?
No, I think... Well, maybe the jump came through working on the orchard, but we always worked there with the intent of starting something of our own one day. Mm. So, yeah, we used that orchard opportunity to get some more experience and save up some money to start our own farm.
That'll work.
Yeah.
What specific... You talked, Maylene, earlier about the fact that you were doing a lot of the paperwork, you know, keeping track of things. Mm-hmm. Did that give you a sense of trajectory into a farm of your own? That, I mean, it's made it more practical to be thinking that?
I think it really showed me how unsustainable our current industrial food systems are.
Yeah, the orchard's not an organic farm.
It's not, and it's not a, it's a great, like, most amazing place to work, but our total food system relies on so many little crutches. And the farmer actually, like, when I was inputting, like, her sales slips from the packing house, the amount a farmer gets paid for their fruit is criminal. because they take on all the risk too. And so they don't even know if they're going to have a crop. But most apple farmers, and this would be like a high estimate, I would say, would be getting 20 cents a pound. And that's if you're getting good money. And that's what the farmer gets. And that to me seemed really unfair. And we also witnessed a changeover at the farm where she moved from hiring travelers and sort of transient people for the farm season to working with the seasonal agricultural worker program. And I supervised her crews for the 3 years that we worked there. And so I worked with both the international teams and also the SOP workers. And so, you know, I got to know all the people I worked with and had some good conversations with them. And I think it really made us want to do something different. And for us, I think a big part of our growth plan would be that anyone who works for us makes enough of a wage that they can start their own farm, that they can put money aside. So when we were working in agriculture intentionally, we also had a second job, both of us, working in retail, and we banked that whole paycheck because it's also expensive to start a farm. So
sure. It's interesting because at the beginning of the show, I was mentioning values and values and how important they are. Obviously, when you go from urban centers to rural, you go from, you know, more mundane, standardized, you know, industrial kinds of jobs, you know, sitting in front of a computer, Robin, you know, dressing up every day to go to the office to do, you know, some very organized kind of work. There has to be some value that drives you. It isn't just something where you say, oh, that'll be fun, because you know it won't all be fun. It'll be hard work as well. But the thing that motivates many of the people on the show is this sense of purpose. We're doing this for a reason. It's not just, you know, lighthearted alone. It's some lighthearted moments.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Then things started to get a bit rocky, and we're going to talk about that now. So a change took place from the situation you arrived and started in on your farm. You had a landlord who was terrific. He was, in fact, a former organic inspector. So he knew all about organic farming, and he also was involved in the value-rich world of organic farming. And you worked with Tessa Wetherill, who's now Tessa Thompson, and the young agrarians to help, you know, do what she calls the marriage counseling to get the landowners and farmers together. And that was going along really well. And then the landowner had a problem with his health or some health in the family and decided he had to sell. And that's when things started to go off the rails. So, Maylene, why don't you start reciting this particular saga?
I guess it came to a point where they needed to sell the land. And so at first he tried to find an investor who would buy the land so that we could stay on the land. And so we met this investor and had many conversations with them about what could be possible on such a piece. Ultimately, it wasn't quite what they were looking for. So then he sold it on the open market. And he really went out of his way to try and find a buyer that would understand, you know, what we were doing on the land. And he owned the land for something like 16 years, and I think he really cared about it. And so he wanted to find someone who would respect what he had kind of protected in a way.
Sure.
And he thought he found that in the person he sold it to. But in the end, that's not quite what happened. So
Robin, what happened?
Well, the person he sold the land to at first came on really nice to us and told us we could stay forever on the land, and they wanted to start, well, she bought it, basically the property for her daughter, and the daughter wanted to start a horse tourist business on the land, and we could all work together. And everything seemed fine in the beginning, but then things got downhill once we pushed back once on a rent increase, and we just informed her of the legal structures that are set up for residential tenants.
So what are specific legal kind of arrangement that you pointed out to her?
Just that she went over the 1.5% legal increase rate and that she has to give us 3 months' notice. And after that, she came really harshly back at us, saying, my lawyer advised me that you guys are now on a commercial lease and I can raise the rent by 50%.
And was it a commercial lease, Maylene?
No, it's always been a residential lease. I really honestly believe that this person is just trying to bully us off the land so that she can get a higher paying tenant there. So we've recently filed with the residential tenancy branch and we have a hearing in the spring. But this is a person who has already bullied other tenants off the land, our friends who used to rent another dwelling up the hill, and continued to harass them even after they had an arbitration with the residential tenancy branch. Their story is very different. It would take a long time to get into it. But I think that this person was deceptive from the very start. And
led you astray.
I think so. The former landowner, I'm aware that he took a lower offer from this person on the land because they said that all the tenants could stay for at least a year. Mm. And that was important to him.
So he was led astray as well.
Right.
Dear me. This is sort of like every leaser's worst nightmare.
Yeah.
Discovering that the land that you are put your feet on is being taken out from underneath you, as it were. Now, when we were talking, you also described how you had kind of anticipated something like this, not like this necessarily, but a move at some point would take place. And how did you insulate your infrastructure, as they call it, the buildings and things on the land, to make it a little more mobile?
Right. So mostly everything is movable that we built. Our walk-in cooler is built in a cargo trailer. And the greenhouses that we have right now are not affixed to the ground, so they're movable structures that we move every year for crop rotation reasons. And so, yeah, we were really aware of that when we lease land, we cannot put in any affixed to the ground greenhouses because... Yeah.
But you didn't think that at some point you would be sort of descended upon by a new landowner who was going to give you a very hard time and start to push you around fairly aggressively?
I mean, we didn't expect that to happen, but I think we always knew it was a reality.
That you were vulnerable.
Right. Yeah. And so that's why we built all of our infrastructure mobile. Like even we completed a chicken tractor this year, again, on a old camper trailer base. So that can roll too. But that was just a little bit of, I think, smart planning because we never expected to stay on this piece forever. You know, we're leasing 2 acres on the shady side of a very narrow valley. And so it's not even ideal agricultural land. And so what we were really looking for was the opportunity to get some good data about the type of farming we participate in so that we could go to a lender or someone someday and say, no, we actually can do this on such a small piece. Mm.
Because I've talked to other people who are doing that, and that's often an important criterion that you say, we know what we're doing. We've done it successfully. You know, we're good investment. Mm-hmm. You know, please take us seriously.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. What did this do? Okay, let's say this is an irresistible force meeting an immovable object. Your values don't accept this kind of behavior. And we talked a little bit earlier about seeing around the world that agriculture is not well supported in financial and material terms, but you didn't probably think that you would be on the receiving end of the kind of bullying or the kind of mistreatment that agricultural workers around the world are famous for having to be subjected to. What was it like being on the receiving end of this kind of, you know, harsh and sort of unfair treatment?
It's really heartbreaking. To kind of have a person come in and, I mean, in the end she would take away our home and our farm that we put a lot of work in, which we are able to build up again anywhere if we just put the man hours in. That's not the biggest deal, but she is taking away food from a community. And we're a small farm, but we do have a lot of customers every week at the farmers market. We feed a lot of people.
Absolutely.
And, yeah.
I've eaten some of your veggies and enjoyed them greatly. Maylene, what was it like for you seeing this, this kind of behavior that was not exactly what you expected and that nobody would want to see and in fact meant that you had to resort to fairly stringent responses to say, you can't do this, can't
right.
do this.
I think it really underlined how precarious our agricultural industry is. If farmers have no security to the land and the workers who are doing the work are generally mistreated, that's really scary for our future in both communities and as a country, you know? I think it just underlined all the things that I had questions about when it came to agriculture. I think really working in agriculture, I came becoming a labor activist in some sense. And a lot of people have come to us saying, oh, we have some land that we don't want to deal with. Maybe you'd like to farm it. But it's not just about the land. It's a lot more complex than that.
It's about human relationships as
yeah.
well.
And also, I mean, as organic farmers, the most valuable asset we have is our soil. And if we have no security to that, then how can you build a business on that? It just feels very impossible.
Well, it certainly feels like this particular location has, whatever the outcome is going to be, as you said already, you'd plan to move at some point, and now you're going to do that with this kind of shadow hanging over you. But on the other hand, with the values that you brought, and something quite important to have a set of values inside yourself that you allow you to recognize immediately that this is not right, this is not the way things should be. So what plans have you been evolving as this process has been happening around you? One thing is that both of you have been working off the farm. Last year, I think you were full-time on the farm, but Robin, but you've been working off the farm to make yourselves, a little more viable, a little more financially stable. What's the next step now that this is shaping up?
We enrolled into the REACH program with Andrea Gunner, and our focus is on developing a business plan that allows us to go to lenders, and we're hoping that in the future, or pretty soon, we'll be able to purchase our own little piece of land and have the security that a farmer needs.
Maylene, what about you? I mean, obviously, this is your plan as well, but what's it feeling like to do this?
It's very stressful, but I think also very necessary. And I think we maybe got pushed in this direction earlier than we expected.
Mm. And not the way you expected.
Yeah.
You thought it would be more a voluntary choice. And
correct.
We're ready to move.
Yeah. But I think we're ready for that. And we're going to do our best to find a way to grow the business so that we can have some security.
I really do think listeners today have heard a story that is not uncommon, the story of starting one place and ending up another place, and then having this roadblock on the way. But I think they've also heard two young people, young because I'm a little older myself. When I was a kid, people your age looked a lot older than me. But we're learning about resilience in terms of people saying, we want to do the right thing. We want to make things happen the right way. And when you meet this kind of behavior and it underlines why you're doing what you're doing, it's sort of strengthening your resolve. And I congratulate both of you for the effort you put into your farm and for the future that I think your name, Robin, famous.
Right.
and proud and love land, loving the land. I think it's interesting how your names embody some of the things you've been doing now. And yeah. I'm just absolutely delighted to have you on the show today and join us. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome.